Annyeonghaseyo, welcome to episode 3 of the North Korea podcast. Every fortnight we are looking over the 38th parallel and into the world's most secretive, intriguing and to many the most frightening country on the planet. Why does a small nation of 25 million people matter and so often dominate the headlines? Today we are looking at tourism in North Korea. Why do people visit? And what do they think when they are actually inside the heart of the Hermit Kingdom? I will be talking to several tourists who have recently come back, including Ben Roberts, who visited the famous May Day Ariane Games, and Tom O'Brien, a student at Harvard University, who has visited recently, in last week, several cities across the country. First, we're going to have a look at a roundup of this week's news, including a high-profile defection from the north to the south.
Well, this is a big news story south of the border. The Seoul government, and I must say it's not been verified yet, the Seoul government has been claiming that a senior intelligence officer with the North Korean military has in fact defected to the south. Now, the defector is said to be a, and I quote, senior colonel with the North Korean Reconnaissance General Bureau. Now, that bureau is, in fact, in charge of espionage operations against South Korea. Now, they call spying one of the oldest games ever. Well, if it is a game, I think, and this is true, South Korea have just scored a big win.
And a development on the missile front.
Oh, absolutely. Now, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has boasted his country has developed a missile engine that would make it possible to launch a nuclear strike against the US. Now, the news agencies in North Korea reported their leader as saying, and it's very, very wordy, so bear with me. Now the DPRK can tip new type intercontinental ballistic rockets with more powerful nuclear warheads and keep any cesspool of evils in the earth, including the US mainland, within our striking range and return them to ashes. Now, it's obviously stepping up the war of words between North Korea and Washington, and I'm sure it's something that Barack Obama doesn't want to be dealing with as he prepares to leave office.
And tell me about the ghost ships off the Japanese coast.
Oh, this is a fascinating story. Now, this is a story from the Los Angeles Times, the LA Times, that says a flotilla of ghost boats, that's words used by the newspaper, about 14 of them, carrying more than 30 decomposing corpses have washed up on Japan's west coast. Now, the boats are said to bear unmistakable signs of North Korean origin. Their hulls were emblazoned with painted numbers and Korean script. One was marked State Security Department and another Korean People Army. A tattered North Korean flag flew from one of the boats, and there were photographs and posters of the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un inside. Now, nobody's quite sure what has actually happened here, and one theory being put forward by the LA Times is that soldiers were sent out by the North Korean army to go and fish for their leader, to make big catches for Kim Jong-un. And of course, they were inexperienced fishermen. They didn't know the ways of the sea. They didn't know how to sail. And in fact, sadly, they've all perished at sea, and the tide has taken their boats to the west coast of Japan.
That was Simon Harris with the Weekly News Roundup. So more about this fascinating story of North Korean ghost ships with dead bodies ending up in Japanese waters. The story was first reported by John Kamen of the LA Times and is particularly sensitive with the issue of abductions from Japan of North Korean officials taking place in the 80s, causing huge controversy in Japan. I spoke to John via video link from Beijing, who told me more about how the story of dead bodies ending up washed ashore on Japanese waters is going down in Japan, and more about the details of the story itself.
I remember in the winter, there was a very small, short period in, I think, December, and there was a spike in stories in Western press about these North Korean ghost ships that were washing up on the shore of Japan, some of them with dead bodies inside, and wondering why nobody was giving the issue more attention. And so I was out in Japan on a reporting trip for the Fukushima anniversary and decided to go out to the West Coast where these ships were washing up and ask around.
Do we know any more about the stories of the people who were on these ships?
The people on board had already been dead for a number of months. So when morticians and investigators began looking at these bodies, I think they were already in such a state of decomposition that they had trouble really gleaning any clues as to their origin. That they were likely military. They were probably fishing on government orders.
What do you think this tells us about North Korea and the state of the country today?
Some academics in Japan say that if you take this mystery back a couple steps, you'll find that the reason they were sent out to fish was that Kim Jong-un has ordered the military to send its commercial fleet out and catch more fish. And yet, because North Korea is so poor and so cut off from the rest of the world, these soldiers were being sent out with little training, equipment to brave tornado or whatever. They wouldn't have been able to survive it.
What's the reaction been in Japan to this?
That was actually one of the biggest surprises of reporting this piece. The people out on the coast really didn't seem to care that much. People kept on asking me why I thought people in the West were interested in the story. I mean, being across the sea from North Korea has yielded a constant barrage of these ships or pieces of these ships. They come in every winter. It was a real discovery for me that strange things washing up on the shore in the west coast of Japan is an old phenomenon.
So Japan has had the issue with abductions, North Korea stealing Japanese people in the 80s and so on. How big an issue is that in Japan?
I think it's still a major issue. I think it's compounded sort of knee-jerk response of fear and uncertainty after the nuclear tests. But I think in communities, especially along the west coast of Japan, the abductions are still raw. You know, this is something that happened many years ago in the 80s. There's never a conclusion. You know, in many cases, the fate of those who were abducted is still uncertain. Even whether they're still alive is uncertain. This is still a very raw issue.
That was John Kamen from the LA Times talking about North Korean ghost ships in Japan.
So, after US student Otto Warmbier was sentenced to 15 years hard labour for stealing a sign on a North Korea tour, the debate has rumbled on as to whether going on holiday to North Korea is actually a good thing to do or not. Those who support such tours say it offers the North Korea people themselves a rare window into the wider world, whilst those against point to the fate of those people who have been detained, just like Otto Warmbier, and the moral impact of providing tourism money which could eventually end up in the hands of the ruling elite. We're back to our reporter Simon Harris, who has more.
You can enter North Korea by train from China or by a small number of airlines allowed to land in Pyongyang. However, citizens of the US have to fly in. CNN says most visa applications are approved with no problems, unless you're a journalist, so I guess I'm staying put. Regardless of whether you're on your own or in a group, two Korean guides employed by the state-run Korean International Travel Company and a driver will accompany you at all times. This means you aren't able to get out and explore at will. The North Korean government will detain, prosecute, and sentence anyone who enters the country without first receiving explicit official permission and an entry visa from its government. Most Western governments warn against travel and say that if you do, your paperwork must be in pristine condition. You can take your phone in, but the SIM card won't work. It is, however, possible to purchase local cards from a booth at the airport. The pay-as-you-go SIM allows users to make and receive international phone calls or call any other foreigner in the country, providing they've got a phone and a similar SIM card. There's no 4G access and international texting isn't allowed, and you won't be able to call your guides either, as they're on a separate North Korean network. The Runga People's Pleasure Ground is a big attraction, but most tours focus on the capital's monuments, museums, and natural attractions. Most tours tend to be around the big national days. February February the 16th is the late Kim Jong-il's birthday, now known as the Day of the Shining Star, a national day with sporting activities and mass dance. Another big day of celebration is April the 15th, the anniversary of the North Korean founder Kim Il-sung's birth, known as the Day of the Sun. More marches, more dancing, and more sport. April the 25th is Army Day, and May Day is celebrated with the usual military parade. Victory Day is July the 27th, and marks the Korean Armistice. Victory Day leads into Pyongyang's mass games, a hot tourist ticket if ever there was one. It usually takes place from July through to October. Its arts and gymnastics event features more than 100,000 performers, participating in a spectacle of colour and intricately choreographed shows.
Thanks, Simon. So, the May Day Games, or the Ariane Games, or even the Mass Games, which Simon briefly talked about, are the spectacular yearly highlight of a highly choreographed performance event involving thousands of dancers, acrobats, and children. Over the years, it has become one of the most recognised features of the closed-off country. The thousands of colours and cards which change in a split second have become synonymous with the North Korean state. I spoke to Ben Roberts, who visited with his girlfriend, and after the games have now been officially closed off in the last few years, he was one of the last people to witness these live. I asked him in a busy downtown cafe just what it was like to see this incredible spectacle in the flesh.
It was absolutely mind-blowing, completely awe-inspiring, not because of the quality or the sophistication of the entertainment, but just the sheer scale of it. The stadium itself seats, I think, over 100,000 people, and in terms of performers, you probably had the best part of 50,000. It was mind-blowing. Nothing else I've ever seen comes close to it in terms of the scale.
And can you tell us more about, you know, the colours you've seen and the people, and it looks so colourful. Can you tell us more about that?
The thing that was most difficult to grasp was every performance was trying to demonstrate a different aspect of the life and culture in North Korea. You had no programme, so it was very... It was just very difficult to... It was difficult because it was overwhelming.
But I mean, when you say different aspects of North Korean society, what can you remember? What sort of aspects that they were showing?
It started off with things like education and scenery, landscape. But then towards the middle and latter half, it was focused on military might. So backdrops with pictures of... automatic weapons, nuclear weapons, and so forth. So it was trying to demonstrate the power of the regime.
And what was your favourite part of the performance, or perhaps the most impressive?
Most impressive was... I just need to describe the stadium to put this into context. The stadium was like an oval, but with one side cut away, and instead was a near vertical stand, and that stand has 20,000 school children with different coloured cards, and they make the mosaic backdrop for the performers on the ground, and they're changing these cards once every few seconds. And during one particular performance, which was about education, they had two figures of school children in a playground, and these children holding up the mosaic cards made the two cartoon characters blink during the show. That just really stood out for me, to somehow have these 20,000 children providing that was...
And how did the crowd react themselves?
It was very steady throughout. There were huge cheers at the end of the games, but during the games themselves, the music was incredibly loud, and the stadium is a very wide open bowl, so the atmosphere does tend to disappear.
And how would you compare it then to other showpiece events like the Beijing Olympics or the London Olympics opening ceremony?
It's most similar to the Beijing Olympics opening ceremony, but five times the scale. If you can imagine at the Beijing Olympics opening ceremony when you had hundreds of drummers all performing in sequence, try and imagine a similar thing but with 10,000 people on the floor performing.
We will have more from Ben Roberts later in the episode. So, tourism to North Korea almost always centres on a tightly controlled visit to the show capital Pyongyang. Life in Pyongyang, which features many imposing and famous sites which are often seen in the news, is relatively well documented. Life outside the capital, however, is far more of a mystery. Tom O'Brien, a student at Harvard University, has, however, just done what very few people ever do. He visited the cities of Razon, which is close to Russia, and Chongjin, North Korea's third largest city. This is an incredible rare insight into life within these two secretive cities. I asked Tom how he ended up visiting.
I went as part of a group of graduate students from various graduate schools at Harvard University. We traveled to North Korea for, I think it was approximately 8 days. We started off, we flew from the US to Beijing, China. Went on to Pyongyang. We spent a few days in the capital, Pyongyang. Then flew up to Orang, up in the further north in the country, and traveled to Chongjin on the road. Then finally up into the Rason Special Economic Zone, where Rajin City mainly, and then went further north and across the border into Russia.
Can you tell us what you've seen in Rason?
Yeah, for sure. So we, like I said, we drove up to Rason from Chongjin, and we were there for approximately 48 hours. First observation, crossing the border into the Special Economic Zone, the border of sorts. Much heavier security than anywhere else we've been in the DPRK. There was an extensive check of electronics, or at least they threatened to conduct an extensive check of electronics. I think it wasn't for the entire group, only for a few folks. Went through bags, looked at all of the written copy we had on us, books, anything like that we had to give in. And much more extensive surveillance, I think, than we'd experienced in Pyongyang or Chongjin.
And what did you go to? Did you see, because Razon is a port city, right?
We did. We went down to the port. We saw they called them Rajin Port 1, 2, and 3. We went particularly to number 2, which is operated by the DPRK. 1 and 3 are operated by Chinese businesses and Russian businesses, respectively.
And did you see any Chinese or Russian businessmen doing business out and about, or was it just very much you see North Koreans?
We didn't see any Chinese businessmen. We were told that they were really omnipresent in Rason, and that local hotels, local spas, massage facilities were really frequented a lot by Chinese businessmen, and there was a pretty constant presence. So, you know, we saw the port, we saw a garment factory, went to the bank. One of the most interesting experiences in a way in Rason was going to this market, the Rajin City Market, where it was one of the times, I would say, where we experienced the greatest distance, the greatest independence from the minders that accompanied us on that trip. We were semi-free to walk around the market and engage with sellers. People were haggling over the price of coats and scarves and hats. So,
and how did people react to you, Tom, as a foreigner in North Korea?
It's an interesting question. And, you know, I sort of had two observations about that. The first was a common reaction that you've seen before in countries where very few foreigners come, which is obviously eyeballing you, being very interested in you, deriving a certain amusement from your linguistic challenges in bartering over this coat or this scarf. But then actually a lot of other people who I'm sure, or quite likely for the first time, this was their first meeting with a Westerner, even with a foreigner, perhaps beyond Chinese businessmen or Russian businessmen who come into the special economic zone, but who didn't react in that same, would really be staring at the ground, or you sensed were very hesitant to engage with you, even to look with you.
Moving down to Chongjin, not many people ever get to see Chongjin from the outside world. Tom, you're the tour guide, you're promoting Chongjin. Can you tell us about life there?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. We had a very limited exposure, really, to for Chongjin. But, you know, it sounds like it is indeed the case that very few people get to go. But it was a very restricted visit to Chongjin.
What did you see exactly?
We happened to be there at the time of this 70-day campaign. So in the morning, we were told that we'd be going out on this sort of walking city tour. It turned out it was really just walking down the street with a huge team of minders, watching a short performance from a group of women there waving flags and knocking on drums, a big musical performance that was there to encourage people to go to work.
What did you experience in relation to the 70-day campaign?
Yeah, that was really everywhere in the time that we were there, you know, from the propaganda that you saw on the sides of the streets, which actually was particularly present in Chongjin, I would say, to these performances all over all three of the major cities we saw. You'd walk around the corner, or, you know, we'd drive around the corner and you'd see a group of women, principally women there with these red flags doing a performance. And again, this is designed to encourage people to be working extra hard.
Were you told anything by the guards in terms of the 70-day campaign that you had to be extra careful?
The opposite. I think they were very proud of the 70-day campaign. You know, when we were there on the first Sunday, they were very eager to explain that usually on Sundays we don't work, but during the 70-day campaign, everyone goes to work. So they have a 7-day working week during the 70-day campaign, or at least that's what the guards told us. They were very keen to show us these musical and dance performances there as a sort of encouragement in theory.
And the three cities you visited, the guards themselves, can you just tell us a bit about how they reacted towards
you? Yeah, I think their experience in managing these international tourist groups. So they were very professional. They spoke very good English in all of the cities that we went to. Obviously, the conversation is fairly limited, and even with them, there are major limits in the kind of topics that you can engage with and discuss. There are a number of instances where I think we started to tread too close, possibly, to topics that were uncomfortable, even talking about sanctions and the way in which sanctions came about, the fact that China had co-sponsored the UN Security Council resolution that brought these sanctions on the DPRK into effect. Someone asked a question to that effect, and it was quite quickly shut down. So they were very careful to be charming, and their English was excellent, and clearly they were experienced, but there are also very clear lines that you couldn't cross in engaging with them.
Otto Warmbier was arrested and put to hard labour for 15 years for stealing a sign. I'm assuming you didn't steal a sign, Tom, but did you sense any extra, did you feel extra unsafe, or did you feel any hostility?
You know, the guards within 30 minutes of arriving, the minders really reminded us of this case and of what can happen if you're not on your best Korean manners, as they described it. We stayed in that very same hotel in Pyongyang where this happened. It's obviously a very sad situation. It seems to me that a lot of the details that what happened still aren't clear. It supposedly pertains to what happened on the fifth floor of this hotel, for which there is no button in the lift. That was quite the
fantastic, infamous fifth floor, right?
Exactly, yeah. So it wasn't clear, but at the same time, we were there on the very day where he was... When I say there, we were in North Korea, not that we were there in person. We were there in North Korea on the day that he was granted his sentence. So it was a very clear reminder, not that we necessarily needed one, of quite how serious this situation was, and just how important it was that we didn't stray beyond that line.
And you visited the show capital, Pyongyang. Can you tell us the difference between Pyongyang and the other two cities, Chongjin and Razon?
Yeah, you know, there are a number of interesting differences. The one that struck me, and it was sort of a random observation as we were walking, driving around, was actually in the clothes that people were wearing. So in Chongjin and then up in Razon, people were wearing much more muted colours comparatively, greens and greys, and looking like much more standard issue clothes. I saw people wearing very similar shoes. Even men were just with black leather shoes. I noticed that a great many were really the same design. Not all of them, but a great many. Whereas in Pyongyang, an individual dress, there seemed to be greater variety in what people were wearing. You know, wear great big long leather boots or have a colourful jacket, you saw men wearing trainers. These are sort of banal observations, and the reasons for those variations, I'm not sure. Is it a question of relative economic wealth? Is it greater access to products that are being imported from China? Or is it an extra degree of individual choice in clothing that's afforded in Pyongyang relative to those other cities?
You mentioned clothes there. What about entrepreneurial life? Did you see any difference between entrepreneurial activity in Pyongyang and Chongqing and Rason?
Talking about entrepreneurial life, even up in the special economic zone, I don't think it's really entrepreneurial life in the same way that we might define it back in the US or in the UK. Even the sort of garment factory we visited works exclusively on government contracts and really isn't running as a traditional business would. It's exclusively churning. For example, you know, it's producing school uniforms. That's its biggest contract. It's all with the state. The contract is guaranteed. That's how all of its business comes in. So insofar as the special economic zone had greater entrepreneurial economic activity, it's obviously constrained in a major way. And, you know, we met with a North Korea state official in Rason. That was an evening briefing. We had a sort of head-to-head discussion with him, and we were able to ask questions about the administration of the special economic zone.
And what was the response?
It's clear that, you know, we got to ask some really interesting questions about what the impact of the sanctions might be upon the special economic zone, what the main challenges were for Rason heading forward. And, you know, I think we didn't get particularly detailed responses. But one of the takeaways, I think, for me, and this was born out of a question about how the Rason special economic zone competes with other special economic zones in the region, is that it's not the same, an equivalent special economic zone in China. It isn't entrepreneurialism and capitalism in that same sense. It's much, much more restricted.
And how was North Korea different from what you expected? I mean, was it different?
I mean, going back to that earlier comment I made about being really hesitant to draw any black and white conclusions about the place, you know, we saw really what the government wanted us to see. We saw the absolute best of the country, the best of its hotels, the best of its restaurants to offer. What we saw with our eyes was not a Pakistan, a Democratic Republic of Congo, a Somalia in terms of its economic status. We saw relatively well-developed houses and phone wires and people with mobile phones that were connected to a certain North Korea intranet. This was not the absolute destitute poverty that you might see in a country like a Bangladesh or a Congo. The question that was always in my mind, both literally and metaphorically, was what's on the other side of that hill? You know, when you're up in Chongqing, you're up in a part of the country where we know that a lot of the labor camps are, and there's been a lot of the famine and malnutrition in recent decades. So that was always the big question for me.
What was the most memorable moment of your stay in North Korea?
In Pyongyang, we went ice skating and we played table tennis at this sports facility in the city. And I think it's the, you know, there were kids there playing table tennis there on the ping pong tables. And we sort of rocked up, and without speaking any Korean, a couple of asked us if they'd be open for a game. And they were, and we just had good fun. We had a good laugh about scoring points and all of us generally being rubbish while they were pretty good.
That was Tom O'Brien, a student at Harvard University, with his fascinating insight into North Korea. Life is changing in the DPRK, with the increase of information access for ordinary citizens and the gradual opening up of the black markets, meaning North Korea is going down a semi-capitalist system of marketisation. However, the one thing which most certainly hasn't changed is the strict restrictions for overseas visitors. Ben Roberts told me about his experiences visiting Pyongyang in 2010.
We would get picked up by the coach from the hotel at, say, 8 in the morning, driven around to everything we were going to see that day, taken back to the hotel, and we weren't allowed to leave the hotel.
And how did the local people react to you when you did come into contact with them?
We only had a few occasions where we were in really close contact with the local people. The first was on the first full day we were there. We went to see a statue of Kim Il-sung near the demilitarized zone. In a park, there were a group of, say, 70 to 80-year-olds in traditional Korean dress. And they were playing music, and they invited us to come and dance with them. We then did come across this same group of people about 3 days later. So
you think it may have been staged.
Yeah.
And what was your impressions of North Korea? What were your first impressions of Pyongyang when you visited and you got off that plane?
Just the massiveness of everything about it. The roads, even general roads going through the city, are incredibly wide, often 4 lanes, but with very few cars on. Pavements about 5 meters wide. Every building is colossal. There's on the edge of the city, there's a giant triumphal arch leading in with a, I think, a 10 or 12 lane motorway going through.
And were you told strict instructions about how to behave near certain statues and monuments?
Yes, before being shown any statue, we were told exactly what direction we had to approach it from. Often we would have to bow in front of it or present a wreath of flowers at the feet of the statue, and then how we were supposed to walk away as well.
And you mentioned before you went to an orphanage, and could you tell us a bit more about your experiences there?
Yeah, the orphanage was probably the most difficult site we saw, because we were shown through the various rooms, the various classrooms they had, and the final part of the tour was a performance by some of the youngest children at the orphanage. And the performance by these three-year-olds was extremely impressive in terms of how perfect it was, but all of the children had rotting teeth, and to get them to perform quite complicated dance and song routines to that level, we felt showed that that was all they were doing at the orphanage day in, day out.
And what else did you do in North Korea? Did you go, is there anything which really sticks out in your mind of what you did and what you remember at your time in Pyongyang?
Yep, going on the metro in Pyongyang was very interesting. All of the metro cars were presumably donated from East Germany because they still had German graffiti etched in the windows. There were museums dedicated to everything. So we got to see a museum dedicated to the building of the metro. This commemorated the North Korean people's heroic struggle against flood water. There was also a bottle factory, a model bottle factory that we got a tour of. Each day's itinerary included, I think, at least one museum which commemorated a certain technological feat by the Koreans in building the city.
Right, and my final question is, did you really sense that the North Korean guards believed in what they were telling you?
I think for the most part they did. Our main guide certainly a few times gave very rote remembered answers, but also you could see she was very genuine in how she answered most questions about life in North Korea. And I remember having a conversation with one of the other guides about sport, because he told me he was interested in basketball, and all he talked about was what a great team the North Koreans had, and they'd been training, they'd been given training videos donated by Kim Jong-il, and he seemed utterly delighted with that aspect of his life. So it felt very genuine.
So every episode on the North Korea podcast, we're going to ask our main guest the same 3 questions about North Korea. Last episode, we asked Sharon Stratton from the North Korea Strategy Center. And this episode, we asked Tom O'Brien, the first question being whether he sees North Korea ever collapsing, and if so, when.
I don't see North Korea collapsing. I see it being on a more gradual road to change, facilitated mainly by increased access to information, increased access to flash drives coming across the border. That is a huge change in the information landscape in North Korea. So I think transition more than collapse.
Is the Korean reunification dream possible?
I think it is possible. I think it is becoming harder and harder. At its base level, I think populations on both sides of the border want to see that happen. That was an almost a surprising takeaway from North Korea. But as time goes on and particularly younger generations become more skeptical, it becomes harder and harder.
What is the most unusual story from North Korea you have ever come across?
The propaganda about the Football World Cup. There were posters talking about North Korea's football success at the World Cup. That was everywhere on the side of the road, seeing
In which World Cup?
The Football World Cup, I suppose the most recent Football World Cup. Propaganda posters all over the place showing, you know, pans clutching the Jules Rimet aloft with a North Korea poster in the back, North Korean flag in the background, clearly celebrating, inferring, I suppose, that they'd won the World Cup.
That was episode 3 of the North Korea podcast. You can find me on the iTunes website, and you can find me also on Twitter at the NK podcast. Feel free to leave a comment or review. They're always appreciated for good or bad. Thank you very much for listening. 감사합니다. 안녕히 계세요.